Welcome to The Steer, the show where we talk to writers about music and musicians about books, hosted by Jeff Alessandrelli and Joshua James Amberson.
Joshua.
Jeff.
What's your favorite color?
Historically blue.
Oh, why? Yeah.
I just wear a lot of it. I don't know. I'm drawn to it. I'm wearing a very bright blue sweatshirt right
now. I would
now.
Say that's teal.
Teal, yeah.
That's more of a green.
You think this is more of a green?
I don't know. It's dark in here.
Yeah. I mean, I like things in the blue palette.
Yeah.
Including teal.
Well, I would say mine's forest green. I ask my students that, and it's a hard question to say why, and that's, yeah, like, why is it, but why is your favorite color your favorite color? But I normally say it's soothing, or it's like mm-hmm. I don't like yellow, really, which is my dad's favorite color.
Oh,
I find it discordant, and mm-hmm. I don't really, you know, but some people, one of my first memories, actually, because my childhood, like, when my first room was painted yellow, probably because they wanted, like, literally my first memory is me looking up kind of in my crib, and some of this might be made up from years, and it was just all yellow around.
Yeah. And you had a reaction.
Well, it's just something that embedded. I remember. Yeah. Like, I guess. I don't know if I had, like, a quote-unquote reaction, but I remember yellow, and I remember looking up, and I remember feeling confined within, like, a thing.
Yeah, interesting.
You know that Beckett claimed to have memories in the womb, Samuel Beckett.
Oh, really?
That's what he claimed. I mean, I don't believe it for a second, but that was a claim. Steven Steinbrink,
yeah. So I have been familiar with Steven's work for a decade now, I think.
Gosh.
Maybe more. He used the moniker. It was, you know, one of those things that was part band and part just moniker, you know, like the Mountain Goats or something. But he used the moniker French Quarter for maybe 5 years or more before he switched to just using his name on his albums. But I meant to probably tell a lot of Olympia stories in these intros, but he came to Olympia maybe on one of his first tours and played with my roommate at the time's band, Polka Dot Dot Dot. And that show is just kind of this, for months afterwards, this French Quarter record was just kind of getting passed around town, you know, and people just were just really excited about Steven as a songwriter in this project. And he's from Phoenix, and so he was on tour from Phoenix. And and I really liked it. I mean, they're just really, those early French Quarter albums are just really solid pop music, and he has just an kind of odd voice. It's very high, and it's kind of a bit of an acquired taste, but once you get into it, you just kind of see just what an amazing pop songwriter he is. And I liked it all, but it really was when he switched to his own name and he started writing just much stranger lyrics. And this album he put out, I think in, I want to say 2015, Arranged Waves. That was really the one where I was like, oh, something is different now. These are actually better pop songs than he's put out, but they're also really, lyrically, just really odd. Really, really surreal, and you know, like little puzzles that you kind of have to pick apart. And so he's actually, I'm kind of surprised he hasn't had something bigger. I think he's a bigger artist in Europe than he is in the U.S. His label is out of the U.K., and so I think he gets a lot more play, you know, on BBC than he does on college radio stations here. So, but he's kind of
He's not that old either.
He's not that old, yeah. But, I mean, he's put out three widely distributed albums. And yeah, and he's still just, when I mention his name to people who are not in kind of the particular area of the Northwest music scene, because he lived in Olympia for a while, so kind of has a connection to the Northwest. But when I mention his name, most people, it doesn't register for most people, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm kind of surprised. I kind of have expected, just given the kind of long renown in the indie music scenes that he's been a part of, that I just kind of figured by this point he would have kind of had something, you know, that would be a kind of a breakthrough for him. So,
well,
yeah.
His new album, Utopia Teased, is mm-hmm. going to, I'm in, and this interview is going to, going to be huge.
Yeah.
It's going really, to.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad we can do this for him, you know, offer this.
No, this will be, yeah. Okay. Steven Steinbrink, The Steer.
For a long time.
Yeah, yeah. Like 12, 13 years?
Yeah.
Something like that. First tour I went on, I was 16.
Oh my God.
But, and it was, you know, lifestyle for a while, but I haven't been doing it too much, or at least to that extreme. Lately.
Yeah. Well, that's longer, right? If you've been touring since you were 16?
So. Yeah.
Because you're 30 something?
31, yeah.
Okay. So that's 15 years.
15 years, but. Yeah. Yeah, I guess more full time. In the middle there, like about 7 years, I was, you know, touring about 6 months out of the year.
But wow! Yeah,
lost my mind and had to chill for a little bit.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I just started. I did the. I went on tour in September, and then I'm doing this tour right now, and that was the first tour that I've done in almost 3 years. So I took a big break.
Yeah, I saw your post that you said that you hadn't come to the Northwest in 3 years.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize that was just no touring at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
What would you do during that break?
I started an apprenticeship at a stained glass conservation studio.
Oh, interesting.
In Oakland. Yeah. So I've been doing that full time the last 2 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, wait. So you're an apprentice, or you're like an artisan now? How does that work?
It's kind of both. I mean, I started off doing weatherproofing for these old conic stained glass windows that are in Grace Cathedral in San Francisco.
Okay.
And I started weatherproofing them. So the panels are rebuilt. They're conserved at that point, and then you use this really nasty marine oil based putty. It smells like dead fish, and you just shove that under the flange of the lead came that is, you know, makes up the skeleton of the window, and it's kind of like the gnarliest job there. So I just did that for 6 months, and
but how did you
weatherproofed him real good, and then they asked me to stay. So.
How'd you initially get into that, though? I mean, had you always that because
it's stained glass.
That
I hadn't even thought of or noticed much stained glass until then, and I was just looking for a job, and I heard about this job weatherproofing stained glass, and I wasn't selling anything, or mm-hmm. you know, working with people directly, and that's kind of what I wanted to do. I was like, what?
what kind of work do I want to do in between tours? And I was thinking, well, I want to be in a room by myself, and I don't want to talk to anybody, and I want to be able to listen to music and audiobooks.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the job, but then it just kind of spiraled into something else. So,
do you find yourself passionate about it now?
Love it. It's wonderful. It's weird. I mean, it's such an interesting field. I mean, it's the intersection of many different lines of work. So it's like, you know, architectural construction, mm-hmm. and fine art, and I don't know. It's pretty fascinating. So
yeah.
Every project is different. So, and I started off, weatherproofing, and then started learning how to build stained glass from a stained glass master from France, and
who lives in the bay,
and
that's where you're.
Anna LaRue, and she's
okay,
an incredible woman,
and you're based out of Oakland.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are you an A's fan?
I'm
a huge A's fan. My dad's side of the family's from. Well, now we're gonna move to me. Well, my dad's side of the family's from the Bay Area, so
yeah,
I grew up a big Oakland A's.
I've never been to an A's game. All of my roommates, huge sports fans,
But not you, not so much. Okay,
I just like it never really captured my imagination. I was in Phoenix visiting my dad a couple of weeks ago, and we watched a part of the World Series, and I was like, I think I get it now.
Like, the appeal.
Baseball is kind of exciting. It's like, it's when it's a good game,
right.
I understand how the tension is captivating.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like that is the appeal. I was really into baseball as a kid.
Yeah.
And that kind of held tension was really interesting to me. And to a lot of my friends, it was really boring.
Mm-hmm.
But I pitched. And I loved games that were just really slow.
Yeah.
Because that, like, the pitcher controlled, because it was just so fascinating to me. So a no-hitter or, you know, a really low-scoring game was just my idea of the perfect game. And to all my friends, that was the most boring game. They wanted games with home runs couldn't stand baseball at all. So
yeah.
Currently, Jeff is wearing an A's hat. So you're really showing your...
Always.
Yeah.
Great graphic design, though. I mean, you know.
Iconic.
Iconic symbol right there.
So, before the job, were you an audiobook fan?
I mean, not so much, actually, but I was just wanting to just have a mindless activity where I could absorb media.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you find do you consider yourself an audiobook fan now that you have the job and you're listening to them more?
I mean, sometimes it's... I find myself being really picky, you know? Mm. Like, I often find myself being really critical of the readers and, like, style that they read.
It changes everything, right?
Or audio quality. If it's, like, a very compressed file, it's like I can't get past it, you know?
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, I really love it when the authors read their own stories, but that's, you know, that's not always the case. So
yeah. Any favorites from the audiobook? I have not. I've heard a few while I've been traveling or on the road, you know, but I don't never really had the situation where like I can do.
I love I love Miranda July's collection. I mean, she's such an expert at reading her own stories, and so much information is conveyed.
Yeah,
you know, in
the short story collection.
Yeah,
I love that book.
In the way that she reads it. I don't know. I really like the Writer's Voice podcast too.
Yeah, me too. Yeah,
The Writer's Voice podcast.
Yeah, the New Yorker Writer's Voice podcast. But
okay.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like something is lost when the author isn't reading their own story.
It makes sense.
Or unless, you know, if there's a very skilled reader who has their own take, but yeah.
Yeah. How does it feel to be back on the road now that You've had some time off.
It's interesting. I mean, I feel like I've changed so much in the last 3 years, and it's easier.
Interesting.
For sure, in some ways. I think the shows are better. I'm more selective about the shows that I play, so I'm not taking as many risks, which is good.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think I'm just, my psyche is more stable now, so I can kind of roll with the punches a little more.
Right.
I find myself getting less annoyed and less stressed and prioritizing sleep and food.
Yeah. Right. Good things to prioritize. Yeah.
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 Did you start, what did your parents do? I mean, how did you initially get into music?
Yeah. My mom was an art teacher growing up, and an artist, a painter, and my dad is a psychotherapist. And yeah, he was a pastor.
For like a
congregation of young people at ASU for the first 10 years of my life, and then he started a psychotherapy practice.
ASU is
Arizona State University.
Arizona.
That's where I grew up, in Phoenix.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. So they are not inherently musical, though?
No, my mom plays piano and is a wonderful singer, but no, I wouldn't. I don't think they'd identify as musicians.
Okay.
But my sister is a musician. She sings opera in New York. So
interesting.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. So we're kind of like two different paths, but
right.
You know, that's what she did in college, and so pretty deep in that world that I don't really have a complete understanding of, but admire greatly.
I just learned that opera's, it's never amplified.
No.
I didn't know that.
At least slightly.
I didn't realize that. I've never been to an opera, frankly, but I had a friend who just went and saw Madame Butterfly.
Great opera.
I'm told. But like Pavarotti and those people, they never, in these like bigger places, they never use amplification. That's wild.
I mean, that's a part of the training is just how to project your voice.
I didn't realize. So your sister, though, is your sister older or younger?
She's younger. She's 2 years younger than me.
Okay. And you started playing kind of at 16, or were you always instruments? You had a piano at the house?
I had a piano. I took piano lessons when I was a kid and hated it and didn't care about it at all. And then heard Nirvana and the Beatles in the same month and was just like, ooh, I should do this. And my brother got a guitar around the same time, and I felt deeply competitive, and I was just like, I'm also going to get a guitar, and I'm going to be better than him.
Wow.
it was just like a
career as
like,
a musician started
just
in competition.
Like this, like, fucked up, like a weird competitive pursuit, which is kind of shameful to admit, I guess. I wish it was more but yeah, I mean, that's what it was. But I was really into the Beatles and Nirvana, and
this is how you're like 14, 12. How old are you?
I think I just turned 13.
Okay.
That's when I got my first guitar.
Are you a better guitarist than him now?
Yeah.
Well, you won.
He's an incredible painter, you know, that was always his thing, he painted the album, the I Drew a Picture album cover.
Oh, really? Oh,
wow.
It's a painting he gave me when I was 18, and so yeah, I mean, that's his deal.
Interesting. What do your siblings or family in general think of your music? Do you have any idea?
I think they like it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, because they were supportive. You've been supported to a degree, right? I mean, everyone's an artist. All the siblings, right? Do you have three siblings? Or?
Yeah. I have another sister too. She's 8 years younger than me.
Oh.
She's a writer and a singer too. And,
gosh. So okay, cool.
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely cultivated in our family when we were younger, but you know, I mean, I think to some degree, my parents have had moments of panic thinking about all our careers, but it's mellowed out in the last I don't know, half decade or so.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have a sense of how many tours you've gone on since 16?
I don't know.
No yeah, way.
Probably
no way to count. Yeah.
30 or so.
Oh wow. Yeah.
Maybe less. Maybe okay. more. I'm
yeah.
not sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That seems like a sensible
probably
number.
Less. Maybe 20.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you like? What I feel like everyone when they travel has a different thing that they like to read or can or mm-hmm. can't read.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I feel like you have a lot of opportunities in a very specific context to figure out.
Definitely.
Figure that out. Do you, what do you read on the road?
Well, I mean, I've never really been a big reader of novels. Mm-hmm. And I think mm-hmm. because, I think that's because of touring so much.
Yeah.
And
why is that though?
Well, I mean, short story collections are, you know, if you have 45 minutes
mm-hmm.
Before soundcheck, it's really easy to just sit down and read a short story than it is to like, or at least the way that I like to read novels is I like to sit down and read for several hours and you know, read 100 pages and then put it down and then go back and
mm-hmm.
yeah, I think the novel is best experienced in as little time as possible, but it's hard to do that when you just have tiny chunks during the day.
Yeah, I didn't.
Especially when it's really noisy and people talking and music playing in the car.
Yeah, so. Yeah. I've over the years when we've talked about books, you know, seen you at various shows and things. I feel like we usually talk about short story writers, and it made me think about. I thought about it not in terms of the practical aspect, but kind of your songwriting and, you know, and how just the idea that a short story creates a very small world, you know, and
definitely.
A lot of the authors that we've talked about are more of that Chekhovian kind of, you know, the just like looking at daily life in through a microscope kind of writers.
Absolutely.
And so I was like, oh, maybe like the short story is something that's inspiring to you mm-hmm. as a writer as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are definitely some like structural parallels mm-hmm. for sure. I mean, like how to communicate an idea or a feeling succinctly, but with as much power. And I think it's more difficult. I think, or at least talking to friends of mine who write short stories as opposed to longer form fiction, it seems. Seems like a more difficult craft to master.
To distill and compress like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or at least it just packs more of a punch, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not, there are exceptions to that rule. Yeah. But for sure.
Yeah.
Or to that opinion.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Now, so you're young. Did you start writing lyrics? I mean, were you reading a lot as a younger? So Nirvana, the Beatles, like how did the two mix? Or I mean, were there lyricists as you kind of grew older? Or was it, I assume it was music first.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it wasn't so. Yeah. For sure. I mean,
because.
It's funny because when I started writing songs. When I was, you know, in my late teens, I wasn't reading that much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, outside of school work, and it really, really took a while to kind of establish that hobby or practice or interest. But I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Well, I mean, how, like, we asked you, like, so some of your favorite lyricists, and I assume these came a lot later, were Katie Davidson,
for sure.
Hannah Reid, Judy Sill,
So some early.
Well, I guess I'm just curious how, most musicians, I think I found, the music comes first and then the words come secondary. But, I mean, I guess as you grew older, you started in your late teens.
Uh-huh,
some
uh-huh.
musicians, they never really care too much about the words,
sure,
which
is
completely fine, too.
Yeah.
Did you start consciously or subconsciously kind of thinking about what you were saying and how it dovetailed with what you were playing, or is it just kind
of? I think it started more in realizing what I didn't like.
Okay, great. That's what didn't you like?
Well, I remember, like, you know, got really into the Beatles, really into Nirvana, and then Elliot Smith. I heard Elliot Smith really early, and And then my like next kind of obsession was the Who. I really loved the Who.
The Who, great.
And like learned how to play guitar, basically,
really?
To those records. And
who got you into them? Because you're young.
I don't remember. Yeah, and after about a year of listening to them, I realized that their lyrics are awful. They're so bad.
Okay.
Like, and it like. It like sucked all the air out of my excitement for them. I was just like, I like this music, but like these lyrics, completely empty and like half-assed. And what am I supposed to do with that? Like, and I think that like feeling that disappointment was a big motivator to like the music and the lyrics had to be equally good for me to spend any time listening to it.
Huh.
Does that make sense?
No, it makes perfect sense. But you were cognizant at like that the lyrics are not nearly as good as this music when you're like 18 or something.
Yeah. I mean, but I think it's easy to tell when like a songwriter isn't sincere or like isn't really feeling what they're singing.
Really?
And I think maybe it was with the Who is like really obvious. I mean, besides like how just like disgusting and misogynistic their lyrics were in some cases, but I mean, I think like, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe another example of that is the Beatles, where like, I think as they progressed as a band, it's like Paul McCartney's songs were about nothing, absolutely nothing. It's just so much wasted potential. Whereas like George Harrison and John Lennon, like their lyrics became more honest and more personal and just kind of like subtly picking up on that difference. And I don't know if I was like completely cognitively aware of that concept, but it's something that I felt at least. And I think that, I think sincerity is felt first and then intellectualized second. So I think for many years I didn't really, you know, think of it in that way. But
yeah. You knew it intuitively.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. But you know, I like continued to listen to Elliot Smith and
whose lyrics you liked.
Yeah, I love them. I think some of them are really great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're in Phoenix, very far away from kind of like, but
yeah. Yeah.
Well, you can be any. I love Elliot Smith. You can be anywhere. I mean, I grew up in Reno, Nevada, like, but it's a very different landscape. I don't.
And then you know, that it shifted for me after that. And it became less about like things, you know, things from the past or like, you know, music from very far away that I was listening to. And it's when I started playing shows and seeing lots of bands in Phoenix and playing with lots of bands in Phoenix and it, experiencing that firsthand, you know. I opened for Magnolia Electric Company when I was 17. And saw Jason Molina, listened to his records. I was like really blown away by his lyrics and then, you know, also Manieri and then introduced to that world and just, you know, kind of a different approach, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a different kind of songwriting. Yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, and then my, you know, sphere of influence, you know, expanded and I also could interact with the people that I was listening to and start becoming influenced by friends of mine that were writing lyrics and kind of getting that direct feedback from, I don't know, interaction with your community.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think it changed. I mean, I'm sure at some points you were talking about songwriting with these people.
Yeah, totally.
But also I feel like there's a difference in just the how to say it, but the when you know someone and you're also listening to their records, or when you've been listening to some records mm-hmm. and then you meet someone and you have an actual interaction with them, you know, that you kind of see the lyrics differently, or mm-hmm. it changes. And especially in your case, where a lot of these people that you really admired as songwriters were becoming your friends mm-hmm. as you were touring and playing shows with them and seeing them multiple times. Did that kind of uncover something or unveil something for you about the songwriting process?
Totally. Yeah.
Or like the person versus the song.
I mean, I think like I met Katie Davidson from Dear Nora when I was 15 or 16.
Oh, so young. Okay.
Yeah, and they grew up in Phoenix, and
I didn't realize that.
And so when they would visit their family, they would usually play a show at the record store. It modified the All Ages venue, or Trunk Space, the other All Ages venue there. And do I need to move this closer?
No, you're good.
Okay. And you know, we played shows together and listened to Mountain Rock a lot. and getting to know them, and they were a huge influence on my songwriting for sure.
Yeah.
And just like, I don't know, this like indescribable quality to their lyrics were just really important to me.
But like, we're writers and we often we workshop things, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and I assume you weren't doing that with Katie. I mean, is it something
seeps in
and you see what someone like that is doing?
I've never done that. Like, my practice is really not to show anybody anything until it's done.
Really? Yeah. So, okay.
Yeah, like, I think it's a mistake for me personally to show people an unfinished song or to ask their opinion.
Interesting.
It's pretty damaging to my process.
Oh.
Because you're sensitive to criticism at that point in the kind of like creative process?
I think it's like, maybe. I mean, I don't know. And I can't say for sure that that's not an element to it. It's like the fear of being criticized and not being able to take it. But I think it's more about, I don't know, strengthening my intuition and like just really trusting that, and like, I don't know, building that muscle to just like trust my own experience and to trust if something is good or not. And it's really paid off for me, I think.
Sure. Yeah. Maybe creating something that you love rather than something for an audience.
Yeah.
Perhaps. I don't know. Yeah.
And I think that my impulse to share and ask for input is often based in fear. Mm-hmm. It's like if a lyric of mine makes me feel uncomfortable, or it's like if it feels too personal, I think in the past I would show the song to someone and be like, how does this make you feel? Like, is this does it make you feel weird? Does it make you feel uncomfortable? But over time I've learned that like those lyrics are the ones that are the best.
They're the ones that people
like
comment
if,
on.
If
or,
something
yeah.
makes me feel weird and uncomfortable, I know that it's a good lyric.
Yeah. that's an interesting gauge. You often work like entirely alone in the recording process. I mean,
I have a few collaborators for sure, but like Andrew Dorsett and Paul Benson, and then Nicholas Wilbur from Anacortes, who has engineered a couple of records. But, but yeah, Utopia Tease was done alone.
Yeah. Interesting. So, I mean, you're playing all the instruments, and in that case, and earlier albums, you're recording it all as well. So it really is kind of, you know, it's not being workshopped at all, you know, because even in the process of recording, when you're bringing in other people to play music or even just sit at the boards, then you're getting that feedback. Even if they're not saying anything, you just kind of are hearing it through someone else's ears.
It's funny with in working with Nick on Anagrams, and then this record that I've been working on for like 5 years. I don't know when it's going to come out.
Oh, wow.
But, when I do vocal takes, when the song is almost finished, I'll do a lot of editing right before I do the take. Just because, like, the act of singing for an audience, like, changes the context for me, and sometimes mm-hmm. I'll need to, like, shift a word or, like, shift a perspective or you know, I'll make lots of edits at the very last minute.
Interesting.
For a song.
Yeah. That seems hard to yeah. do. I mean, some people can't do that. Like, is that, do you learn that on the fly? Because you're changing a lot, right?
Yeah.
I
yeah.
mean, and melody and rhyme and all that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, the cool thing about recording those is, like, nothing's ever final.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Like, you can
do take after take.
Yeah. It's like, to me, it's just like, oh, I'm editing right now. Like, editing right now as I'm recording the vocal take is the same as editing, you know, like, sitting at home at my desk. There's no difference.
Interesting. I mean, yeah. I often, I don't know if you do this, Jeff, but I often do this before reading. That I'm reading it, and oftentimes I'm on the bus and going to wherever I'm reading, and I'm just crossing things out, and, you know, and I know a lot of other writers who do that for readings. I've never heard of it in the context of, you know, recording. I'm not never, but, you know, I think it's maybe less common, but
Because the work changes when it's you know, just between you and the words, and then when it enters other people's ears, it's like it takes on a life of its own, and
I feel the closer it gets to an audience, the more it changes, that more that your perspective, your internal editor, you know, steps in. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm doing a reading tonight, and I'm right now, I'm like, oh, what I'm reading, I've never read it before, but I think it's, I practiced it yesterday, I think it's going to go fine.
Yeah.
But I'm sure within, you know, when the reading's an hour or two away, I'll feel differently, and I'll start editing because the audience is so close. Right now, it's the morning, it feels far away, that I don't, my internal editor is just not on. You know, and I imagine it's the same with recording too, you know, where once you're recording, it's like, oh, the audience is right there. You know, like, I'm so close to it. And even when, you know,
curtain's about to open.
Curtain's about to open. Do you think that, so I've been listening, I've been at least a casual fan for a long time. I think it was one of your early tours that my roommates at the time, played a show with you in Olympia.
I loved that show. And that was like a life-changing show for me.
And and a lot of people were talking about it. You know, afterward, you know, I mean, I just suddenly heard that first record you put out everywhere in Olympia, because it was just kind of getting passed around, it felt like. And so feel like, and when did that first record come out?
2007.
So over the last dozen years, that you're lyrically, it's gotten a lot weirder, you know.
I mean, cool.
Not just, it hasn't just of you know, it feel like it hasn't just that you as a lyricist hasn't just aged or matured, but it's just, it has gotten different. It's a different thing now. And I think to the benefit, I'm into it. But do you think has anything to do with this process, this kind of insular process? Or is that just you as a person getting stranger?
Yeah, I have like no perspective of how to answer that.
Yeah.
And maybe that's because of the, how insular it is, but
yeah,
I mean, I have like, I don't know.
Well, it's hard. It's hard to pinpoint things, especially over 12 years. And sometimes, if you pinpoint it, then it can get in your head that that's the way I, you know, like, because it is time. A doesn't exist, and B is very fluid.
Totally. I guess there was like a time, like a point around, maybe like 2012, like around maybe in between, or maybe around when I recorded, I drew a picture.
Okay.
Where things just felt a little more focused. Like, mm-hmm.
Is that when you, around when you changed monikers?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. That's when I started performing under my own name. And I mean, that record is specifically was, I mean, I felt like I was leaving Phoenix and writing this weird, like, speculative sci-fi concept album about about someone, you know, living in Phoenix in the near future when the water supply was cut off. And
now I remember the
dying
song. It's apocalyptic. Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was, you know, kind of focusing. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to Olympia and things felt a little more loose and free there.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's when you wrote and recorded Arranged Waves, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the first album. I mean, I did listen to I Drew a Picture, and now that I'm thinking back on it, that it is like this kind of sci-fi, you know, desert nightmare kind of thing. But Arranged Waves was the one that I think maybe because it wasn't conceptual, that mm-hmm. these were just seemed to be, you know, not unconnected pop songs, but just that they were, there wasn't a story being told. That one really stuck with me as I was like, oh, something's changed.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
You know, that
yeah, a lot
like,
changed.
I was just like, Stephen's a different songwriter now.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really interesting where he's gotten to. But, I mean, it kind of came with a lot of hardship, right? Because those songs aren't, you know, about having a great time in a place.
I mean, I guess like personally, what was happening around then is like, you know, I moved to Olympia and like, started experimenting with psychedelic drugs simultaneously while like going to a lot of therapy.
Hmm. Whoa!
So okay. It was, mm-hmm. it was, you know, just like really deeply confronting my memories and I think like if Arranged Waves is about anything, it's just about like perception mm-hmm. and memories
yeah
and how horrific that can be sometimes.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I definitely felt like I was kind of gently exercising something with that album.
Yeah.
But
yeah, how do you feel about Olympia now?
I mean,
you don't live there.
I like going back. I think about it a lot. But it's also like, I don't know, my memories there feel really abstract. I feel like the second I moved there, I became a different person. And then the second I left, I was a different person again. It was just like,
wow.
I just changed a lot as a person there. And I'm really grateful that I lived there.
Yeah.
But it
wasn't easy.
It wasn't sustainable at all. I couldn't live there forever.
Yeah.
But
I forget, Jeff, have you ever been to Olympia? We're going into an Olympia.
I have been there. Right. How long did you live there for?
For 3 years.
Oh, really?
A little under 3 years, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why did you decide there from Phoenix?
It was kind of impulsive. I just knew that I wanted to leave Phoenix. I was living in this weird house for free in Phoenix. Basically, a friend of a friend had foreclosed on his house and was trying to short sell it and needed someone to stay in the house so that it was in a kind of a gnarly neighborhood, and they needed someone to stay in the house so that people wouldn't strip the house of all the copper piping or something. Because I guess that was happening a lot at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I was living in this house, and I recorded I Drew a Picture in that house. And then they sold the house, and I left Phoenix, and I didn't really know. I went on this like 2-month-long Greyhound tour, which was ridiculous. Whoa. And I feel like I could talk about that for 2 hours, but I won't.
A musical tour?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was ridiculous. It was.
You were what? 18? You were young.
Oh no! I was 24.
Oh, you still a little bit. Okay.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I lived on a Greyhound for 2 months, essentially, and to say it was a tour is a overstatement for sure. But
you played a lot of shows along the way.
Yeah, I played it maybe some like shows. Half the time I was playing shows.
Okay.
for very little money.
Yeah.
Then Eli Moore from Lake texted me. I was driving. No, I was in a bus in Houston, and he told me that there was an open room in his house for $175 a month.
Okay. Those are Olympia prices.
I was like, all right, I'm there. And so I my car was in Portland in a friend's garage, and I took the bus up there and then drove to Olympia with nothing and started living there. But it was great. I mean, I was living with Ashley and Eli from Lake, and Andrew Dorsett lived across town, and we built a studio in the garage, and it was amazing. It was just like this incredible idyllic time.
Yeah.
So like easy. I lived, you know, across the street from the West Side Co-op, and worked very little and was just recording for like a year and a half straight. And that's what arranged waves of while going to intense therapy and getting high a lot.
How did those things, maybe especially the getting high part, influence your relationships or the relationships you had and were building at the time? Because I assume that you kind of knew Ashley and Eli from Lake from touring and playing shows together and maybe you didn't know them a lot outside of that context.
No.
And so was that kind of how did that work?
I think all of my like psychedelic exploration has been very private. So it wasn't them, you know.
They didn't have to.
No,
they didn't have to deal.
I hope not. No, I mean, living. You know, they have always just been so incredibly generous and like made so much possible for me.
Yeah.
Just like, in terms of just simply sharing gear and, you know, collaborating with me, like, you know, I don't think I would have a music career without them.
Wow.
Yeah.
It wow.
Was, yeah, they did. They were incredibly generous and helpful and, mm-hmm. And still are. And yeah, they're just incredible.
They're really lovely people. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been. I'm sure you hear this a lot, but I've been watching a lot of Adventure Time. And though I've never been close with Ashley, she does the closing theme to Adventure Time, and it's a lake song and like a solo version of a lake song. And she and just hearing her voice every 12 minutes or something is I never get used to it. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, hey, Ashley, you know, again. And I haven't seen you for years, but I hear you all the time. Mm-hmm. But there really are the very sweet people.
I had been a fan of theirs since 2006.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh. When I heard their the CDR that they made on Carl Blau's little imprint, the Kelp Monthly, that he was doing in the early 2000s, I was obsessed with it.
Wow,
I listened to it so much.
That's a good CDR.
And, yeah, I mean, I listened to them for years before I actually met them. So. Mm-hmm. I just feel like we kind of spoke the same musical language and had been so inspired by them, and then to be sharing a studio space and a home with them was just like, you know,
yeah,
it really made a lot possible for me. And Andrew Dorsett too. I mean, mm-hmm. he's the most talented, incredible musician I've ever met. And
yeah, and he's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. I've been in the studio with him more than anybody it felt very free, and he's like classically trained, right?
Yeah,
I'm not. I can't read music. I don't mm-hmm. know what anything is.
Yeah.
So, but he's so sympathetic and can translate his musical knowledge to me in a way that makes sense, and vice versa. I think so.
Yeah. And it makes sense that when I first heard Lake, I was like, this is great. I mean, it was probably 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And this is great. I can't imagine this ever catching on, because at the time, no one was kind of referencing the 70s, mm-hmm. like 70s pop mm-hmm. music. And I was just like, this is... I like, it's very cool, and no one else is doing it right now. Mm-hmm. This is just not the thing at this moment. Mm-hmm. And but in the years since then, it's really has mm-hmm. been, you know, so much of mm-hmm. kind of that mainstream indie music has been like referencing the 70s.
Yeah.
And I not so much with your first album, but you know, as you went on, I was like, I really see that you have. Like, you listed Judy Sill and melodically that makes so much sense. And but you know, did you kind of have a do you feel like you and Lake kind of had similar influences?
Well, they influenced me.
Oh,
I mean,
okay.
They,
yeah.
When
yeah,
I was
yeah.
living with them, they were just feeding me music.
Yeah.
You know, like mm-hmm. Blue Nile, Prefab Sprout, Judy
mm-hmm.
Sill,
mm-hmm.
Justin Vollmar, like all of these songwriters with that are very like brilliant lyricists too. I don't know, some of the lyrics on those Prefab Sprout records are just mind-blowingly strange. Have you ever listened to Prefab Sprout?
No. Mm-hmm. Wow. I know their name, but
yeah, I know the name. Yeah.
It's worth a listen, or just like look up the lyrics if you don't like the music.
Yeah,
like, they're wild. Yeah. Please be careful. It's never careful till it hits the gun. She will always pay the bills for the having big fun. He talks so well. What can you do? It's pretty plain. He means it too. I don't want to sell you lines. I only mean to do you right. But I'm a simple slave of appetite. I'm a poor slave of appetite. Hunger howls. Hunger's red. Hunger stays till it's fed. Then it's some. Yeah, their influence on my songwriting is, massive.
Wow. And you listed, it's stood out to me, especially maybe on some of the songs on Utopia Teased, that Judy Sill melodic influence, you know, the melodies and the harmony parts. I just was like, oh, this is so just, you know, referencing this songwriter that I don't hear today. I don't hear people... you know, at least to my ears, you know, kind of musically referencing her.
Yeah.
But you also list her as a lyric, influence as a lyricist.
Yeah, her lyrics are wild, yeah.
Interesting, yeah. And I don't know, when you gave us this list, I was like, I don't know that I've ever paid that much attention to her lyrics, you know?
Yeah.
And maybe talk a little about that.
I mean, she had this like incredible ability to kind of like speak of the divine without I mean, she kind of like almost like romanticized or like sexualized God.
That's true.
Yeah, like she has so many songs about like receiving a kiss from God, or like I don't know, like the interchangeable use of like my man with God and I don't know, seemed unique, just like this kind of very normal way to speak of the profound and divine.
Yeah.
That I really connected to.
Oh, interesting. I like that. Yeah. He can blaze a trail, though the rumbling dims his guiding light to just a spark. When the hour is low, he comes tumbling. But when the moon is high, he gives his heart. Birds are flying, come on, the light is gone. Hope slowly dying, tell me how you come riding through. In and steady till this round is won. On a long and lonely road to kingdom come.
I mean, I guess one of the questions I have, like, is it rare for you to, like, read actual lyrics? You just listen to music and then the lyrics come. I mean, as a songwriter, do you, on the page, do you often like?
If I really like him.
Like, so Judy Sill is one of those people that you would do that.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because then it's more like, I'm a poet mostly, then it's more like poetry, and then you kind of break down. Totally. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
But then there has to be some who you don't really do that because you're not as enamored of either their lyrics or...
I guess I just don't listen to music if I don't like the lyrics. Like,
oh,
that,
really?
That's like, so, that's okay. Extremely important to me. Mm. Like, oh. if the lyrics are bad or if I don't connect with them, I can't listen to it. Basically.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What about where they're indiscernible, like shoegaze, dream pop kind of zone? Is that?
Yeah, I just don't. I can't think of anything off. I mean, I like some like Cocteau Twins songs, mm-hmm. but like not to the point where I'm like, I love this band. You know,
interesting.
Like,
yeah. Lyrics are that important too. That is just.
Yeah, I mean, I listen to a lot of instrumental music too. Yeah. Like, I love, you know, mm-hmm. Cluster and. Mm-hmm. And Stars of the Lid, bands like that.
But okay,
like,
yeah.
But yeah, it's as important to me as a good melody, yeah. For sure.
If there are lyrics, you need them to be good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
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 Okay. Interesting.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So you sent us a list, which we've referenced, about some of your own kind of, are these mostly current or these are people you really like just generally? We got
Yeah, you know, it's hard for me to come up with
lists.
Lyricists that I love, and I was thinking like, oh, well, Arthur Russell should be on there.
Oh,
like,
really?
Mm-hmm. I don't even remember who I put on. Well, I put Katie and Hannah from Lamelda. Yeah. I'm on tour with her right now, but she put out a great record last year called M for Empathy, and it's 16 minutes long, and each song is under 2 minutes, and it's incredible. It's just like very succinct, intense, beautiful songs about longing and heartbreak and depression.
Right.
Yeah.
My girlfriend's actually writing a book about Arthur Russell.
Oh, whoa, cool.
Yeah. Do you know Steve Knudsen? He lives in town. He does Autica Records.
Yeah, I don't know him, but I'm very familiar with
him.
That's
crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've gone so deep with him. Yeah, for sure.
Because he has a new Iowa Dream. Yeah, I just had one.
Yeah, I can't wait for that.
It's really good. Yeah.
It's funny. I'm familiar with a lot of those songs, but I'm familiar of their existence.
Mm. Just in the Arthur Russell world, or how did you?
Yeah. So, gosh, when Love Is Overtaking Me came out, I somehow got a hold of Stephen Hall's email.
Okay.
One of his collaborators, and I was emailing with him for years.
Really?
And we always meant to meet up when I was playing in New York, but it never happened. But yeah, he would just tell me stories and describe songs to me.
Wow. Describe songs.
Yeah,
and then
later on when the biography came out, and mm-hmm. then there's also this guy did his dissertation on
Buddhism.
Like read that in a day, and you know, talks about a lot of songs. So it's just, yeah, I'm like deeply obsessed.
Well, she has an article just out in this literary journal. I'll send it to you.
Oh, that'd be wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. She's in close contact with Steve, and it's different than a biography because she's kind of like she's in it to a degree.
Sure.
But
it's
kind of more creative. She's an Iowa Writers Workshop person.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's good. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
He's good.
And when did you come? I mean, for most people, it was, you know, those reissues of Arthur Russell's stuff that, you know, had such a small fan base, myself included. Uh-huh, I did not know about him till that first reissue came out a decade ago or something.
I mean, the first thing I heard was Love's Overtaking Me,
mm-hmm.
and because I was like 20, 21 or 22 when I heard it.
Yeah.
I'd never heard songs like that. Yeah. I mean, I had heard songs like that, but like lyrically, I mean, like mm-hmm. This Time, Dad, You're Wrong, like, you know, just the directness and, the like, undeniable sincerity of it all. It was just like, I mean, yeah, very profound for me. Yeah, that was huge.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, I could go on and on about that, but yeah. We all know Hawaii's great.
Yeah, he's great. He's so great.
So, but you sent us a list of like literary people too. So Ben Lerner's novels. Then is it Nachman stories by Leonard Michaels? Joanne Kiger, the poet.
Yeah.
Yi-Yun Lee, short fiction. Homesick for Another World by Tessa
Moshfegh.
I guess. Well, I'm curious. Ben Lerner's novels. Like auto fiction or what are you? Have you read the newest one?
Yeah.
Oh gosh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I know his poetry because he started out as a poet. I haven't read the novels.
Yeah, I just started reading them last month. I bought 10 before on tour and and just read it in a couple of days and then
Dug it.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, I love them.
What about it?
I don't know. There's just I mean, it's fascinating how he's kind of like a story collector. He's like a collector of other people's stories. And 1004 too is just like talking, you know, it's the book is basically like figuring out what he's going to, what kind of novel he's going to write, after he gets a very large advance for a book deal. And, it's just, I mean, it's about so many different things. I mean, I guess you could say that it's about this thing or that thing, but I don't know, it's just lots of variety, I guess.
Right,
so many things happen in the book, it just is engrossing. I just, you know, but wanted to read it as quickly as possible.
Read it quick and you really grasped.
Yeah.
And do you like Nosgard, like things that get inside someone's head? Like,
I haven't
really
read any of his books.
Okay.
Yeah, I haven't read that much autofiction, I guess, but yeah, I mean, besides like Chris Krause and Sheila Hedy, I guess, but I mean, it was inspiring to me after reading it, and I thought if I were to ever write fiction or any kind of prose, it felt possible after reading his book.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, that's the highest testament, kind of.
Yeah.
To one work of art makes you think about making another work of art.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I have been curious about this. Do you write for the page ever?
Or never.
Never.
No,
okay.
No.
Yeah. Always writing in the context of lyrics.
But I'd like to. I mean, it's something I've like kind of been thinking about, and I have no idea what I would. Oh, I mean, that's not entirely true. I feel like I've had lots of interesting experiences in my life that could be translated in a fun way.
Yeah.
Onto the page, but
I mean, tour stories alone.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think the main challenge for me would be attempting a new craft and not being very competent at it, and the frustration that would inevitably bring, for sure. I mean, like, songwriting is like so second nature for me at this point that it feels almost like be a waste, maybe, to not keep pushing myself in that craft and seeing how far I could go with it. But
it would feel like a distraction from your path.
Yeah,
maybe?
Just like a diversion of energy that maybe wouldn't pay off. But maybe that's a bad way of looking at it.
What
I think if I were to do it, it would have to be like be a very gradual immersion into writing prose.
Start slow. Just couldn't have it distract too much.
Because I've never been a journaler ever.
Do you journal?
I started a journal this year.
Really?
Yeah. Okay.
How have you been doing?
I was doing it late every day for a while, and then your life, or at least mine, is so much minutia, like that I do it probably like every 5 or 6 days. I found that it does kind of allow me to coalesce some things in my head, and but then sometimes it just seems so banal, and I don't like John Cheever's diaries, and there's other people who's like Kafka, like they have these insane that there's no real division between their literary works and their like inner head, and like mine are like took the dog out, like, mm-hmm. had breakfast. Like, yeah. they're just so, yeah. so, but it's somewhat helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I recently read Leonard Michael's diaries.
Okay.
And they're very much like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like how you described your...
Oh, your, yeah. So your... they're kind of mundane, but he had a more interesting life.
I mean, I guess so, yeah. in a way. I mean, I don't know.
Right.
I mean, mm-hmm. I think everybody has an interesting life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sometimes on tour, we'll do this thing where we'll tell each other our life stories over the course of many, many days. And
very intentionally.
Very intentionally. And, oh. like, every single, like, moment of your life that you can wow. remember. Like anything that comes to mind.
Well, that's
we did it on Dear Nora tour, and it took the entire tour.
Wow. Well, that's like I Remember by Joe Brainerd, right? Yeah. Have you ever read that?
No.
Oh,
I think you'd like it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you would too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's all his memories ever.
Yeah, but yeah, I've done it on a few tours since that one, and I mean, I think like the truth that I'm realizing is that everybody has like. An incredibly interesting fucked up life,
yeah,
right,
with
yeah.
like lots of pain mm-hmm. and like sorrow and suffering and joy, and it's like, you know, mm-hmm. I think everybody's life is interesting even if it seems boring.
Yeah, I teach community ed class writing, creative writing classes through the community college, mm-hmm. and you know, I've been doing it for almost 6 years now, and it's always just so surprising that who brings, especially, you know, largely in the nonfiction classes, who brings the wildest pieces of writing because it, oftentimes it's just not who I would call.
Yeah.
You know, I've just, it's made me, I've already had this understanding of the world or suspicion that mm-hmm. just, visual appearances are always deceiving, mm-hmm. you know, and but I've just it's enhanced that in a really wonderful way, you know, where I'm like there's so many stories, even if I look at you and I can't guess at any of them, you know. Yeah, and totally. And I really love that you know, you just really can't tell that much from looking at a person.
Yeah,
you know, you don't know the stories, you don't know their experiences at all. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah,
totally.
I've always failed as a journaler. Just really bad at it. I've always kept I go through notebooks, you know, but I'm always just kind of writing down lines or making notes on a potential piece of writing, or just kind of notes on life, quotes I hear, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always writing down quotes in all my classes and just things I overhear. Yeah, it's a little less now that I don't ride the bus every day. I mm-hmm. just got a car for the first time in 5 or 6 years, and so I'm eavesdropping less in life because mm-hmm. of it. But so I fill up notebooks, but anytime I've tried to journal, I just can't stand the minutiae of life, life, you know. And I don't, when I'm so close to it, when it's just happened, I don't find it interesting. It's only with distance that it becomes interesting.
Right.
Do you feel like it kind of achieves the same thing though? Like when you go through those old journals and you like look at your notes, like it must be activating of certain memories.
It does.
Like, a time in
your
life, right?
Yeah. Not as much, but when I have gone back to times where I've tried to journal, it's mm-hmm. been so valuable. I'm like, oh, I forgot that my take on these events now. You know, these things happening in my life has changed. It's not what I
mm-hmm.
what I actually experienced in the moment. It's what I came to understand,
yeah.
or, you know, or the story I made out of it. And it's so, as a writer, I really wish I've been keeping a journal for all these years, because then I could reference back and, you know, kind of have, oftentimes when I'm writing about a point in life that has some, you know, great distance, you know, a couple decades or something, that I am just like, I'm at a loss to how I actually felt in the moment, and I'm just speculating.
Could've.
You know, and a journal would be so great with that. But there have been a couple times where I've been going through very specific, usually health-related things. Like last year, I got diagnosed with Crohn's, mm-hmm. and I was basically sick for the entire mm-hmm. year. And then at some point, somebody was like, you should keep a Crohn's journal. And I was like, I can do that. Mm. But still, that was twice a week. You know, I was trying to do it every day, and it ended up being, really two or three times a week.
Yeah.
And it just, I really admire when people can journal, but it's difficult. It's difficult.
Just to end, I guess, how important are titles like Utopia Tease versus do you just know about titles of albums or I guess titles of songs too? Because those are.
I have a hard time with titling. Utopia Tease came, just came to me fully formed, and I was like, yes, that's the name. That's the name of the album. But that rarely happens. Yeah.
So you work at it like this could be this or it could be this or.
Yeah, I have like a. I have like a list of potential album titles. But now, now I'm the next two records, one which is basically done, and then the next that I'm recording in a few weeks, already have titles. So that feels like a new thing.
Mm.
Yeah.
Nice. Can you unveil them, or are they secret until they come out? You should have never said anything.
I think they're secret. Okay. It's funny that for Arranged Waves that I almost titled Arranged Waves "Life Is Perfect."
See, but that's a completely different album.
That's a completely different
Everything
album.
Is the same, but it's completely different. Like that's interesting.
Yeah,
it would change.
It would change it a
the
lot.
Framing of it a
I
lot.
It would though. I mean,
Why? What does Utopia Tease mean to you? Why did that make so much sense to with this collection of songs, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, it's just such an intense album, mm-hmm. or it was so intense to make.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I guess it was... maybe referencing this feeling of like your world like literally falling apart, mm-hmm. you know, like mm-hmm. Or just kind of confronting the idea of like, I don't know, thinking that your life is going to be a certain way and then it changes catastrophically quickly.
I think
we can end there.
We're
good.
Cool.
Thanks. Thank you, Steven.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Steer is recorded at KBOO Studios in Portland, Oregon. It's broadcast through Dublab Radio, KZUT in Los Angeles, and can be found anywhere you listen to podcasts. Thanks for joining us.